It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll discuss the state of homelessness in Wisconsin with experts from around the state. But first, budget negotiators in Congress have reached a bipartisan budget deal that would avoid another government shutdown.
But not everybody is happy with the deal, including the Wisconsin Hospital Association. Here to explain why the association is worried about the proposed budget deal is Steve Brenton. He is the president of the WHA. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon.
Well, it's good to have you along. I wanted to start by talking a little bit. The WHA issued a press release after this, expressing deep displeasure, it says here, with the news about the budget. And I want you to put this in context for me, because in the press release it says negotiators have extended a 2% Medicare provider cut for 2 years. And I think for the layperson out there, you say something like that and you think, well, 2%, that sounds kind of reasonable.
Yeah, and I appreciate that one can get down in the weeds here a little bit, but I think most of your listeners will recall about a year ago when Congress passed this initiative called the sequester, which cut both domestic and defense spending by about 2% across the board. And providers of Medicare services, including hospitals and physicians and others, experienced at that time a 2% reduction from a program that already pays them less than the actual costs for providing care to our Wisconsin seniors. What's very disconcerting about this so-called bipartisan negotiated proposal that I believe is going before Congress as early as tomorrow is that what was envisioned by some to be a temporary cut in payment may become much more than that, because this proposal will extend by 2 years the 2% across the board cut. One other thing to add, this 2% cut doesn't stand on its own as it relates to recent impacts on Wisconsin's provider community from the Medicare program. Just a few years ago, when the Accountable Care Act passed, there were major Medicare cuts baked into that proposal that over 10 years take about $2.5 billion from hospitals. And then since the Accountable Care Act passed, there have been some other budget bills that have passed that have taken smaller amounts in cuts. So this is really this latest proposal, or this latest budget deal, is additive to a whole series of reductions that have come over the past several years. And what we're really talking about right now are cuts that total over $4 billion over the coming decade from hospitals who provide services to some of our most vulnerable population in Wisconsin.
So $4 billion over the next decade. And I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about Medicare funding and the how it fits into, and I don't know if there's a typical hospital or medical center out there, but how it fits into the average budget or a typical budget for a hospital or medical facility.
Yeah, that's a great question. On average, for our hospitals, about 35% to 40% of their revenues come from the Medicare program. But for many of our rural hospitals, in places like Portage and Mauston and Amory and elsewhere, that number can exceed 60%. So, you know, this 2% that continues year after year is cumulative and amounts to a real blow to a revenue stream used to pay for local services and primarily our hospital employees.
So to kind of follow up on that a little bit, 35-40% of a typical budget, up to 60% in some of the rural areas. And you said early on in our discussion that Medicare doesn't cover the full cost of procedures now, of care now. What percentage does it cover?
Right now, Medicare covers about 80 cents on the dollar.
Okay.
And this is for hospitals. For physicians, it's probably lower, quite frankly. But we can document for hospitals, it's about 80 cents on the dollar of actual costs. And Wisconsin hospitals have to make up those losses by charging private payers, commercial programs, more than they otherwise would have to charge.
So this trend has been going on. I remember doing interviews like this, oh boy, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. This seems to have been something that's been going on forever and ever. And the question is, when do we reach some kind of tipping point?
Well, yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, what we have tried to do is to balance and to, in many cases, reduce expenses, especially in the last couple of years, to make this whole thing work. We've had a number of hospitals in the state that this year announced either delayed capital expenditures or actual reductions in employment in order to make the expenses match, you know, these revenue cuts, these revenue changes. I really don't want to cry wolf other than to say that cuts like this that go on and on and on do have and will have consequences on our community hospitals and community providers.
Have you had the opportunity to try to reach out to Wisconsin's congressional delegation today?
Yes, and we've actually been doing it all year. And I think for the most part, our congressional delegation, be they Republican or Democrat, have been quite supportive of the notion of no more cuts, which has been our theme. That's why we are a bit taken aback by this proposal, which does single out providers. But, you know, this is a so-called bipartisan deal with some urgency of getting done. And at this point, I kind of think that the rationale behind these decisions becomes overwhelmed by the politics of getting something done this week. And I'm not terribly optimistic that we'll have much success, which means we're going to have to continue messaging, you know, the urgency of no more and to undo some of the damage that will come from cuts of this type.
Do you think that members of the public have the same insight into this that you do? I mean, you talk with legislators, and this is all very complex. You know, Medicare, Medicaid, all the payment, all the insurance and everything, and you throw in Obamacare as a bonus, and you've got a real mess. Does the public get it?
I think the public is confused. You know, you can get deep into the weeds here on issues like this. But Medicare is a very important program. It is an incredibly popular program for our seniors. And I do think that there is some political relevancy of raising, you know, this as an important issue that must be addressed. But I'm under no illusions that it is well understood. And part of our job is to, you know, keep on working to make sure people understand that there will be consequences for cuts that really are unrelated to the actual cost of providing care.
All right, Steve. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Steve Brenton. He is the president of the Wisconsin Hospital Association.
Up next, we'll look at the state of homelessness around Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development just released its annual estimate of the number of homeless people in the United States, and the news is good. Since 2011, homelessness has gone down by about 4% nationwide.
But here in Wisconsin, it's gone up about 5.5%. To dig a little deeper into those numbers, we're going to do a roundup on the issue of homelessness in Wisconsin. We'll be talking with service providers from around the state about what they're seeing in their communities.
And we're going to begin in Madison. First up is Stephen Schooler. He is the executive director of Porchlight, an organization in Madison that works with homeless people. Steve, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with what you're seeing here in Madison. The overall numbers we have show that homelessness is on the rise in Wisconsin, about 5.5% or so. Is this more or less in line with what we're seeing here, or is it different?
It's absolutely in line with what we're seeing in Madison, particularly as it relates to the shelters and the shelter populations. Already through the end of November, we are at a pace to set a record in terms of the number of nights in shelter that we have served, as well as the number of people we have served. Typically, in any year, we serve somewhere around 32,000 nights of shelter, with a night of shelter being one individual staying one night. We almost hit that number by the end of November, And we anticipate our numbers of nights of shelter in December alone will be 4,000, 3,000 or 4,000. So we'll be well above the record. It's not a happy thing, and it's certainly not something to boast about. But the number of individuals, the number of nights of shelter, the need that we have seen in Madison and Dane County is sharply increased, particularly over the last couple of years.
And I think a lot of people, when they hear about this, you know, speculate that, well, we had the Great Recession, but now we're supposed to be pulling out of it. But these numbers sort of fly in the face of that.
Yes, and I think that, and that's the struggle that I've thought through. But I really think here's the point. The poverty levels in the United States are at an all-time high. Okay, there's no question about that. And here in the state of Wisconsin, that's clear too. I mean, just take an example. 50% of the children in Madison schools utilize reduced price lunch. If you were to take the poverty levels and compare them with the actual number of people, the statistics show that the poverty levels are much higher. What happened with the recession is that hit the lower income people really hard, okay, and the poverty level people really hard. And they were just struggling to make it, but they weren't really on anybody's statistical agenda or statistics. It hit them hard. They lost a lot of their incomes. Some of them lost work. A lot of them are no longer looking for work. And so while they weren't part of anyone's statistics in 2008 or 2009, they're now part of our statistics as a homeless provider.
You know, and people, when they think about the homeless, there are all sorts of stereotypes out there. But tell us what you see walking through the door in terms of demographics.
Well, in terms of the overall demographics, there certainly is a fairly high percentage of persons that suffer from serious mental illness. That's been the case, and it's been the case for a while, and it will continue to be the case. The reason for that is we've deinstitutionalized a lot of these folks. We've put them out of the institutions, and we haven't provided them with the housing and support services once we put them out of the institutions. So there's still 40 to 50% of the adult homeless population does suffer from serious mental illness. There's another portion that suffers from substance abuse that oftentimes is co-occurring with that mental health issue. And not having the treatment services or the housing certainly exasperates that. But beyond that, approximately 40 to 50% of those folks that are staying in our shelter are working, okay? But they're working at jobs that are paying the $8 to $9 an hour wage rates. They're working at jobs that are probably not full-time, that don't provide 40 hours a week. They're working in jobs that are temporary, which will, you know, come and go. And so as a result, they're not able to make the money that's necessary to afford housing. And particularly in Dane County, which is a little bit different than other parts of the state, Dane County has an incredible high rental rate in terms of the cost of housing in Dane County. Couple that with the fact that there's a vacancy rate in Dane County of approximately 2%. And you can see that individuals that may be working the $9 or $10 an hour job, even if they're working 40 hours a week, cannot afford the housing.
So this, to me, sounds like a trend that, from all the things you've outlined, that is not going to be reversing anytime soon.
I wish it would be. I don't think so.
All right. Well, Steve, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Appreciate your time. That was Stephen Schooler. He is the executive director of Porchlight here in Madison.
Now we'll move north and west. We're talking to Deacon Richard Sage. He's the executive director of Catholic Charities in La Crosse, Wausau, and Eau Claire. Deacon Sage, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
We've heard the numbers, homelessness on the rise here in Wisconsin, and we just heard in Madison a record-breaking year, a record you don't want to break of nights spent in shelters. What are you seeing in the cities you cover?
Well, in the areas that we serve, we're seeing probably what would be considered a little bit more rural areas as opposed to the metro areas of around Madison and Milwaukee, but we're seeing very similar things. We have a shelter facility in Eau Claire, 48 beds, and we operate two warming centers, one in La Crosse with 15 beds and one in Wausau with a 25-bed capacity. Especially in the last couple of weeks when it's been, you know, quite cold up in northern Wisconsin, we have been pretty much inundated with guests coming in to see us. The shelter in Eau Claire in particular has been full, and we've in fact run a few extra. We've had a few people sleeping in some chairs overnight. And we have actually had to turn away a few people. We probably average two, three people each night that we have to turn away because we simply have no place to put them. We do allow the folks to come in like that and get warmed up, take a shower if they would like to, have an evening meal. But by 9 o'clock, we know very well if we're going to have any beds available, you know, how many beds we'll have available for to meet our capacity. And so it does give folks a little bit of a chance to call around and things like this because we have lights out at 10:30 at that particular facility. And, you know, then they have to be on their own.
Have you seen this in past years where you were at or over capacity?
Well, we were running close to capacity. This seems to be extra pressure earlier in the season. It's like we've seen it before, but it seems like it's been later on, after the first of the year, maybe in February or March. But this is seems to be a phenomena that we are having right away. And in fact, ever since opening our warming center in La Crosse, for example, which only has a capacity of 15 people. With the exception of the first two nights, the first weekend when we open on November 1st and 2nd, ever since then we've been full every night, and we've had to turn people away from that facility. Similarly, in Wausau, we've had people come in, and you know, it kind of started out a little bit slow in November, but we've been turning people away. These last week, 10 days, we've been full.
So I'm sure there's, again, different stories of people coming through, but put a face on some of the people using these warming stations and shelters in these
sure.
cities.
In our area. This is, we have a lot of folks who we would consider would be fairly chronic homeless people. They're folks who have, they may have a mental health issue or maybe a substance issue or something like this, and we do try to provide for them as best we can, provided they're not presenting in an unruly fashion or anything like that. So there is a certain amount of chronically homeless people that we seem to be able to take care of, and we're pleased to do so. There's also a lot of folks coming in who are, this is the first time. They'll report to us, I've never had to seek this type of assistance before. I've never been on this end. You know, I used to give donations to, you know, the Salvation Army or to Catholic Charities or to some organization, and now I find that I'm receiving something has happened. You know, we lost a job. Unemployment is such that we can't get back on our feet. Our facilities do only accept single adults, so we do not have facilities for families, but we're in close collaboration with some of the other resources in our area. And in particular, we work very closely with the Salvation Army in Wausau, and they are reporting much more pressure with families. And we're seeing that. I believe your previous guest had mentioned, you know, the number of homeless children in Madison. We see that as well. It's a phenomenon in all of our cities, and it's a rather frightening statistic to hear about this, because I can't imagine what it would be like to be, you know, a middle schooler or something like this, and to actually be going, you know, living in a car perhaps, or living in someone's basement or in someone's garage or something like this, and then expecting to be doing well in school the next day. And in all of our locations, you know, we have collaborative ties with the school districts who have homeless liaisons, you know, within the school districts to try to assist with people. The numbers that they report are, you know, very disturbing. When we hear in one of our school districts that there's 150 kids that they feel that are homeless, or there's 100 students that one of them is working with, right away. So that seems to be an area where we're working with some different groups. I attend meetings both in the Marathon County Homelessness Housing and Homelessness Coalition and in La Crosse a Homelessness Coalition, and we're trying to address some of those issues of how are we going to meet the needs of these families and try to keep them safe, especially during our severe winter times.
Deacon Sage, thank you so much for joining us today.
You are most welcome. Thank you very much for asking me.
That's Deacon Richard Sage. He's the Executive Director of Catholic Charities in La Crosse, Wausau, and Eau Claire.
And we'll continue our discussion about homelessness in Wisconsin after this news. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're continuing our discussion on the state of homelessness in Wisconsin now.
We've heard that homelessness is on the rise statewide. We've talked to people who provide services in Madison and in Wausau, Eau Claire, and La Crosse. Now we turn to Milwaukee. Ken Schmidt joins us. He's the director of Hope House in Milwaukee. Ken, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
So are you seeing this increase that we've seen in Madison and statewide over in Milwaukee?
Yeah, there's no question. We've started a coordinated entry project in Milwaukee that really is focusing people through the 211 system into shelter. And just in the month of November, we had 559 families accessing shelter. That's an unduplicated count. And only 47 of those families actually were referred into shelter. We were able to divert 77 into other housing situations, but that leaves a huge gap on the number of families that need shelter and were not able to access it. So really a big issue. Certainly the same problem with single adults, both single males and females.
Are you seeing more families in particular showing up needing some kind of shelter services?
Well, the numbers have traditionally been high, and they continue to maintain the level that they've had in the past. But we are seeing more emergency cases. For example, at Hope House last night, the police department dropped off a small family in our warming room, and we've been working throughout the entire day trying to find an appropriate placement for that family. Generally, folks, families don't end up in that really severe emergency situation where the police are involved. So I think we have a large number of people looking for shelter, and that's consistent. But it's the depth of the emergency that seems to be getting worse.
And why is that? Why do you think it's getting worse there in Milwaukee?
Well, we've had a long, long history here of very low income, very low job development. There is a huge problem with doubling and tripling up of families in households. I just read a report where it's not uncommon to see between 6 and 18 people living in a duplex. And people are just packed together, and it's getting more and more of an issue. Folks just don't have the income to be able to afford their own apartments.
Are there services available apart from an emergency shelter situation to try to get people into housing and maybe out of that two or three families in a house built for one or an apartment built for one?
We do have diversion prevention programs where case managers will go out and work with families and try to connect them to as many services as possible. It's somewhat hit and miss, unfortunately. Generally, folks are more, or the case managers are more successful when they're able to connect the individuals with maybe some distant family members or friends who are able to take them in. There just aren't a lot of services out there. We do have some help with picking up rent costs for certain families, but there isn't a lot of resources for that kind of service.
And we heard in other cities around the state that there are a lot of long-time users, often people of those services, sometimes people with mental illness or substance abuse problems. Is that part of the clientele you see there as well?
Well, certainly there's an issue in a large city like Milwaukee with chronically homeless folks. We have almost 3,000 permanent housing units that are set up for chronically homeless and or disabled adults. We have a good number of other folks out there working in the shelter system. And as we work from year to year trying to develop more permanent housing slots, as soon as a building is completed, they are filled up right away. So certainly a need out there. And with the collapse of the housing market and the difficulty in putting projects together, we're just not able to put units together like we were just a couple of years ago. So the need is there. The resources to develop the kind of housing that takes the chronically homeless off the street, that is very hard to put together right now.
What other things are, do you think, unique to your situation in Milwaukee as Wisconsin's biggest city when it comes to homelessness?
Well, we have a lot of transient folks coming in and out of the city. We have, just a concentration of folks. We have over 9 major shelters in town. They cover issues all the way from domestic violence, traditional homeless shelter, shelter for families, and shelters for youth. So it's really, in some ways, a more complex problem in that we have all these diverse kinds of groups out there with their own unique problems, and we've had to develop a shelter system that really addresses all these different needs.
Are there a lot of different agencies, whether nonprofits or city, county, or state agencies? And if so, how well do they coordinate your efforts?
Oh, there's a number of ways that we coordinate. There's an overreaching group called the Continuum of Care, and that represents projects that provide permanent housing, something called transitional housing, emergency shelter, and a lot of other supportive groups that provide mental health treatment, provide W-2 kinds of services, and the coordination is there. On the shelter side, we have a separate group. It's the Shelter Task Force. And we focus in that group to make sure that funding levels are as strong as possible. We do have overflow that we've been coordinating the last couple of weeks. And we try really hard in this town to do the kinds of coordination so we aren't wasting resources and we are being as effective as we can be.
I've heard in interviews we've done on the show in the past from food pantries that say they're getting a double crunch. On the one hand, there's more demand for their services since the economic downturn. On the other hand, fewer people are able to make donations, to donate food or cash. Is that something you're seeing with nonprofit services for homelessness as well?
Well, it really is an issue. We at Hope House actually open up all our services to the neighborhood, so we do have a food pantry there. And our donations of emergency food are actually down. Our donations to the shelter side have been staying strong. The huge problem has been the impact of the sequester. Just in Milwaukee County alone, the sequester took out $500,000 of emergency solutions grants from the county, and this has happened across the United States. And those kinds of really severe cuts are putting a lot of the programming in jeopardy. So, you know, the generosity of the individuals and foundations in this area have been really strong. It's really the government side that has been hard. And I'm talking mostly about the federal government and its sequester process.
That's at the federal level. Do you see the city, county, and state levels taking homelessness as a serious priority?
Well, Milwaukee County just stepped up to the plate and increased the amount of funding through local funds, $300,000. That was a one-time event, which hopefully we can keep up for years forward. So really, the local governments have been very good at looking at the problem and trying to make up the difference. But truly, it's going to be donations mostly that will make the difference in keeping our doors open.
And I don't want to let you go without asking about the bitterly cold weather. How much is that an acute strain on your ability to provide services for homeless people and just keep them warm?
Yeah, the goal is to make sure that everyone has a warm place to be. So across the city of Milwaukee, there are warming rooms set up at the different shelters and other organizations so people can come in out of the cold. We have a day center who opened up overnight last night and had 18 people sitting in chairs overnight. And as I mentioned before, Hope House had a family in our warming room last night. We do open up also something called Overflow, so we actually have beds available. The Milwaukee Rescue Mission has opened their Overflow, and we will be following up with both the Guest House and the Cathedral Center, which will be opening up some Overflow beds for single men and single women. So we're predicting that we will have enough places for everyone to get out of the cold so that no one is in that really severe situation. And we really hope that people call 211 and flag down police officer, whatever, if they're really in trouble, to access the service. We can get you into a warm place in Milwaukee County.
Ken, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Ken Schmidt. He's director of Hope House in Milwaukee.
And thanks to the other guests we spoke to about the state of homelessness in Wisconsin. Stephen Schooler joined us, the executive director of Porchlight in Madison. And we also heard from Deacon Richard Sage, the executive director of Catholic Charities in La Crosse, Wausau, and Eau Claire.
We'll pick up the story of homelessness in Wisconsin again next Wednesday with the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club in Dane County. He went undercover as a homeless man in Madison, and he'll share his experience with us.
Up next, we'll learn about some ethnic holiday traditions around Wisconsin.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. The holidays are filled with traditions, and returning to these traditions can be one of the comforting and memorable parts of the season. Alyssa Segong found a new way to be part of an old tradition in her family.
My name is Alyssa Segong, and I come from a German family predominantly, about half German on both my mother and my father's side, with a big smorgasbord of Luxembourg and Poland and other ethnicities thrown in there. I have a very nostalgic family, and I've been fortunate to be one of four living generations. I grew up knowing my great-grandparents and a great-great-aunt really well, and their nostalgia for traditions of the farm days in Kenosha and the parties that happened before my birth really stuck with me and still do. And I think that as a mother myself now, I have wanted to find a way to become a part of that nostalgia and put myself into that story. One way that that has happened has been the rebirth of the tradition of the Christmas brandy old-fashioned. Legend has it that my great-great-aunt threw the very best Christmas parties and was a generous hostess, and she and her husband would have a little bar in the basement where they'd mix up brandy old-fashioneds, which was special for Christmas because normally everybody drank brandy with water. So the brandy old-fashioneds at Christmas were legendary, and brandy Alexander's after dinner. And a few years ago, my aunt started hosting a Christmas feast inspired by great-great-aunt Lil's Christmas feast. And so, of course, brandy old-fashioneds were a key component. But where did I fit into that tradition? And I came across a recipe for old-fashioned bitters on America's Test Kitchen, and I thought, that's it. That is my place in this story. And I began researching it and reading through the detailed instructions of making these infusions of mugwort and, you know, all this alchemy that happened. And I knew that that was just my piece of the story. So I set up mason jars and made all my infusions and mixed them and surprised everybody with the Christmas brandy old-fashioned bottle of bitters for the feast itself and for them to take home and remember the rest of the year, hopefully. And the 2013 batch is ready for unwrapping.
That story was produced by Judith Sears-Poisson.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. This episode was produced in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Here to explain now some of the ethnic origins of our holiday traditions is Jim Leary. He's a professor of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison. He's director of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures. Jim, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here.
Well, that's got to be a favorite tradition in Wisconsin. Alyssa shared the story of the family brandy old-fashioned tradition. Now, does the brandy old-fashioned come to Germany, or is there some mystery there?
Well, it's a famous Wisconsin drink, of course, and requisite a lot of fish fries. There's a lot of different ways to make it, including my first taste of it that was sort of a fake version with 7-Up and brandy. and that was with an old fella who was born in 1885. His parents had come over from Ireland, but back in 2006, Jerry Minnick, who wrote a wonderful food column for Isthmus here in Madison and did other food writing, looked deeply into the brandy old fashioned, which has been a kind of a mainstay of Wisconsin drinking, and of course we're up there among the leaders in brandy consumption. And he discovered that it really emerged kind of in the wake of the Columbian Exposition of 1893, when Korbel, which is kind of like the default brandy in Wisconsin, made a kind of a big push and a big splash. And so this was like a popular culture drink, fad drink that became a part of Wisconsin life in the late 19th century, and in part because, you know, there are so many Germans in the state. I think it's been partly associated with Germans, but I know plenty of Irish and Norwegians and Czechs and people of other background who enjoy the brandy old fashioned. But I also like her infusion of bitters, because that's the making of kind of medicinal drinks and infusions with different. She mentioned mugwort. You know, my daughter does different kinds of things, and my wife, and out of the Scandinavian countries, and also kind of North Germany. There's this in Poland. There's this vodka kind of tradition or spirits where you have all kinds of things from honey to birch twigs to caraway to who knows what, raspberries, in it. So all of these traditions are, they're very much a part of life here, and I think they've gotten a kind of a resurgence, too, with all this sort of local brewing and local spirit making as well.
So the brandy old-fashioned is not from the old country, but some of those infused spirits are.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, and for years, I live in Mount Horeb, and one of our treats would be to go down to New Glarus and eat at one of the great Swiss restaurants, and then there was a tavern we like to go to, and we'd get some Appenzeller bitters that have all these different ingredients made by the monks for digestion, and at one point we were there, and the bartender said, "Well, I'm sorry, we don't have it." And I said, "Oh man, this has been such a treat for us, you know." And he reached under the bar and came out with a bottle and poured us some. And then it was astronomically expensive. Mm-hmm. And I found out the Food and Drug Administration made it difficult to import because it didn't list all of the ingredients. So when people would go to Switzerland, the fellow would ask them to bring a bottle back.
Contraband bitters. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, here's another big tradition, moving away from the alcohol. Of course, the Christmas tree. We're seeing those spring up all over the country. What's the origin of the Christmas tree coming to the United States?
Well, you know, these are old pre-Christian kinds of things, you know, the evergreen that stands out, and of course the tree, reaching up to the gods and so forth, and Germans, brought it here to the United States, and certainly they were coming to Wisconsin as early as the 1830s. It got like a big popular culture boom in the 1840s and 1850s because a lot of sort of the East Coast tastemakers in the United States were looking, they always looked to England and Queen Victoria's husband, Albert, was German, and they introduced the Christmas tree, and it became kind of chic. But, you know, we were already way ahead of those hipsters here in Wisconsin, as usual. And then a lot of Scandinavian people came over, and you know, the Christmas tree, the Yule tree, which you put candles on and historically and dance around and sing, has been part of their tradition for centuries, and so it was just kind of brought over here as well.
So Germans and Scandinavians are doing this already, but it didn't make the leap from them to everyone else until Queen Victoria did.
Yeah,
it.
Yeah, right, that's right.
So our obsession with British royalty didn't start with Princess Diana.
No, or with Masterpiece Theater,
right.
No.
Oh, here's a tradition that I associate with the Polish side of my family, celebrating Christmas, not on Christmas Day, but Christmas Eve. That is the peak time of year. Is that just us Polish people others too?
It's really important with a lot of people, although, I mean, Germans as well. But Polish, you know, I spent some time 30 years ago with a lot of Polish people who would have a lot of meatless dishes, fish and cheese and various other things, as well as honeyed vodka and beer, or pivo, on Christmas Eve. But then there was this wafer, the opodic, where everyone would have a little piece of this, and then you might sing Przybyszeli do Bethlehem, or some of these. There's some beautiful Polish carols as well. But yeah, Christmas Eve, very, very important for a lot of people.
Jim, do you have a favorite ethnic Wisconsin holiday tradition that we haven't talked about yet?
Well, you know, I heard the previous piece about homelessness, and there's kind of a family tradition that came through the Welsh Catholic side of my family, and they also lived in Wales for a while. But it's a story that actually came out of the 1890s about a small child wandering homeless and cold in the great city, looking for a place to stay, and of course he's turned down by, you know, various wealthier, well-to-do families, and starts moving to a poorer and poorer part of town, and then sees a light in a little place where a poor mother and her children are having their simple Christmas, and he knocks on the door and is welcomed in. Anyway, it turns out he's the Christ wandering, and he, you know, transforms into light and kind of goes rising up into the sky. And in my family, that was always read on Christmas Eve, and often by the youngest child, where we'd have a gathering of the extended family. And my mother made it into like a handwritten book that all seven of us kids have. Anyway, that's kind of a favorite of mine.
All right. Well, I'll share a quick story about the Polish Christmas Eve wafer. My mother's late grandmother, Polish, one year gave out the wafer to all of us, and it was really tough and chewing. We thought, oh, she's probably had this sitting for years around, and it's gone bad. In fact, she started laughing after we all had it in our mouths. She'd taken styrofoam and pranked us all on Christmas Eve. And after she had a good laugh, she got out the real wafers. Thankfully, that didn't turn into an annual tradition. We got wise to her. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
A pleasure.
That was Jim Leary, professor of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison, director of the Center for the Study of Upper Midwestern Cultures.
Coming up next on Central Time, we'll be talking to a journalist who says Wisconsin's online criminal records should not be searchable. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Verrett. The news is next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
O Tannenbaum, du kannst mir sehr gefallen. O Tannenbaum, du kannst.